Hi, Dr. Dewi. Hi, Dr. Michael. How are you?
Fine.
Hi, Dr. Dino. Fine, thank you. I hope you're well too.
Fine, Pat Dino.
Thank you very much. And hi, welcome to Eyes on Southeast Asia, the premier podcast on foreign policy, security and economic issues in Southeast Asia, brought to you by Foreign Policy Community of Indonesia, the largest foreign policy group in the country. And before we start, I just want to say I'm wearing my 50-0 t-shirt because we are launching a climate campaign to get the Indonesian government to reduce emission by 50% in the next 10 years and to reach net zero emission by 2050. Today, we're going to have a great discussion on the recent political events in Myanmar where we saw military takeover on February 1st. Joining me today are Michael Vatikiotis and Dewi Fortuna Anwar. Michael Vatikiotis is a director of Center for Humanitarian Dialogue, which is based in Geneva, but he lives in Singapore. He's also the author of Blood and Silk, Power and Conflict in Modern Southeast Asia. Professor Dewi Fortuna Anwar is a co-founder of the Foreign Policy Community of Indonesia, also a research professor at the Indonesian Institute of Sciences. And most importantly, she also served as the foreign policy advisor to the vice president. And both Dewi and Michael, thank you for joining us today. And let me start with the first question. Myanmar has seen many military coups before in 1958, 1962, and 1988. How is the recent February 1st military takeover different than the previous coup? Yeah. Dr. Dewi?
Yeah, it's true that the military in Myanmar has this habit of taking over power. There are similarities and there are differences. The coup d'etats in the earlier period, it was, you know, there was the first experiment of parliamentary democracy, which is full civilian control of the government at the time. And of course, then the military overturned that and carried out full military junta throughout the 1960s until, you know, until the 2000. Now, if you look at what happened recently, there's already a shared power between the military and civilian government. So in the previous coups, there was, you know, this liberal democracy in Myanmar, where the military was supposed to serve as a professional military. But because of what they saw as civilian incompetence, because of regional rebellions and so on, the military took over power. But unlike in Indonesia, they did not really have this quasi-constitutional exercise of power. They really just serve directly, you know, without including the civilians. While after the transition to democracy since 2010, and then, you know, with the elections in 2015, supposedly a civilian government, but there is an element of dui fungsi there, as if, you know, the military also serve within that system, and the military is guaranteed a shared of power. And now they are dismantling that, you know, again sidelining the civilians. But now the civilian is much more emboldened. The civil society is much stronger than in the previous era.
Yeah, Michael, how is last month's coup different than the previous ones?
Well, I think in addition to what Dewi just explained, I would just say the main difference, I think, because a coup is a coup. It's when the military takes over and displaces the civilian government. But the main difference, of course, has been the response, and not just the extreme response in terms of outrage and anger on the streets and of all the major cities in the country in Myanmar, but also the way that response has been transmitted to the world through social media platforms, through streaming on phones, despite, you know, internet blackouts in the evening. I think that's the major difference, because it is a coup, the response to which is very much more visible to the world. And I think that's the major difference.
What do we know about General Min Aung Hlaing, the head of the Myanmar military, the Tatmadaw? You know, what kind of general is he?
He's not a well-known person. because he's not been easy to get to know. There are quite a few senior officers around the region who know him quite well. He's quite well networked with senior generals in the Thai army. He knows, you know, people across the region in the armies, but the civilian sector doesn't really know him. We do know that he rose through the ranks and wasn't particularly popular with fellow officers, but was very successful in reaching the leadership level. And we also know that he's very proud of his position and, you know, was seeking perhaps after his planned retirement this year, the role of presidency, perhaps also to protect him from potential persecution, because after the Rohingya expulsion of 2017, of course, the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court has been gunning for prosecutions of those held responsible.
He doesn't seem to be getting along with Aung San Suu Kyi. Is that a safe assumption to make?
Yeah, I like to add what Michael says. You know, from firstly, we don't really know much about him, but from reports, he, you know, his persuasion is he's very hardline. Of course, he's been around. He's been commander of the armed forces since, you know, the 2010-2011. So actually, he presided over that semi-transition to democracy, working in an uneasy partnership with Aung San Suu Kyi. But this is clearly a tug of war. Aung San Suu Kyi's defense of the Tatmadaw in the International Court of Justice, from what I've read, is a two-sided sword for the military, because it gained her great popularity among the rank and files. Although, you know, she earned the criticism from the international community. And that probably is also one of the reasons why there is concern that, you know, the general could be even more sidelined. But he is very much responsible for the attacks against the Rohingya, so the, you know, hardline approach towards the ethnic minorities. So he's not your reform general, despite the fact that he presided over that transition to democracy.
Yeah. Is there, I mean, obviously this was a well-planned coup, because a coup is not something that you do overnight or in a matter of days preparation. Is there any way of finding out, you know, when did they begin to think and plan to launch this coup?
The story hasn't really been disclosed as yet. I mean, there are various theories. One theory is that it was well planned as way back as, you know, a couple of years as a contingency in case, you know, the things did not go the way the military wanted them to go, that they kind of took it off the shelf, maybe added a few elements and then implemented. A more likely explanation is that the process of negotiation was going on between Min Aung Hlaing and his people and Aung San Suu Kyi and her people. The negotiations did not go well. In fact, they broke down. And at that point, it was decided for the army to step in. There must have been elements of a plan, because of course there was a pretty well organized takeover, not so much in terms of military units, but in terms of the people who were put in place to run the government. That implies that they were pre-selected. But clearly, and I happen to know that the negotiations did not go well. They broke down, and the army felt, and Min Aung Hlaing felt, he had no choice. Mm.
Dr. Dewi, is the Tatmadaw, the Myanmar army, as solid as they seem to be, or is there factionalism within the army?
Well, at least I'm not really as well informed about this. But remember, some times ago there was actually a purge. Within the Tatmadaw, a senior general was sidelined, and we hear quite a lot about, you know, frequent purges of elements within the military. I remember a number of generals or officers that I knew ended up, you know, were in jail during that early transition. And recently, of course, you know, there is this desire to present a unified front by the Tatmadaw. But there's some interesting article in the Diplomat recently that one of the reasons why the military push for this coup d'etat is this fear that a lot of the Tatmadaw families actually voted for the NLD. That is why this overwhelming victory of the NLD, you know, 83% is quite huge. And one of the reasons is that, you know, the military sees itself as a symbol of nationalism and national unity and tried to demonize Aung San Suu Kyi. But Aung San Suu Kyi's spirited defense of the military, you know, as you know, Aung San Suu Kyi is, of course, the daughter of General Aung San, but she's been discredited by the military because of her family is British, you know, so she's not really eligible to become president. But her spirited defense of the military over the Rohingya killings and expulsion, as I mentioned earlier, actually earned her a lot of kudos with the wider Tatmadaw, and you know, and during the election, there is a possibility that a lot of Tatmadaw's families and also the military in Myanmar are allowed to vote, and many of them probably voted for Aung San Suu Kyi, and that's probably one of the reasons that, you know, they want to prevent further polarizations within the military. But I think Michael probably knows the inside.
Go ahead, Michael. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't think anyone really knows quite what's going on within the ranks of the Tatmadaw, which doesn't exactly, is not exactly a very transparent organization. But what we do know is that, as Dewi said, a couple of, you know, before the last elections, and in fact, way back after the 2000, ahead of the 2015 elections, there was unhappiness within the ranks over certain generals who were seen as perhaps too politically savvy, you know, perhaps having ambitions of their own, who were purged, using their political party base as a reason for the purge. Secondly, I think it's important to note that there is some evidence of some sort of low-level defections going on, certainly from the police, possibly also from the army in certain ethnic areas. I mean, you know, as we saw in Hong Kong with the Hong Kong police, you know, the people on the front lines of the security forces are being photographed, their families are being pressured. You know, it's a different ballgame from what it was used to be. You're no longer anonymous. And there's a lot of pressure that can be brought to bear on you by your families, by your friends, you know, if you're on the front lines shooting into the crowd.
So, Michael, you live in Indonesia for many years, and you know, the evolution of the military's political role in Indonesia, and it has a lot of similarities with Myanmar. Do you think there's any chance that Tatmadaw one day, like the Indonesian military, will leave politics and become a professional army? Is that too much to ask? Is that such a far away aspiration?
Well, let me give two parts to that answer. I'll, first of all, you know, there is, of course, the official narrative is that the army is adhering to a seven-step roadmap, the seventh step of which would be that the army and the civilians share power, you know, equally in a disciplined democracy, whatever that means. But the second part of the question is really a story that I'd like to tell about several years ago. I was in Naypyidaw attending a conference, and my good friend General Agus Bujoyo was also at that conference, and he and I over some years have discussed this issue. And of course, you know, under President Yudhoyono, there was an attempt to deploy some of characters like General Agus Bujoyo to talk to the Tatmadaw about the possibility of reform and some of the key reformers from the Indonesian military. And we were in Naypyidaw, and we went to visit the Army Museum, the Tatmadaw's Army Museum in Naypyidaw, which is of course quite a large place and is singularly subjective in the image that it tries to project. And, you know, I remember General Agus just kept shaking his head, and he just kept saying to me, you know, there is just no chance that this army is going to reform. There is just no indication. There is no evidence. There's no proof. There's no interest really in the same kind of reform process that the Indonesian military went through. And I'll just finally say that I think it's always important to remember in the reformasi period of Indonesia, and Agus is very fond of saying this, that when the civilian protesters took to the streets and when, you know, ministers in Suharto's cabinet started rebelling against Suharto and in committing a final act of treachery, the army had in fact already started reforming itself. They'd already distanced themselves from Suharto. And so in many ways, it was army reform that came first and then democracy.
Dr. Dewi, why do you think the military wants to always have one foot in politics, the Myanmar policy, Tatmadaw? Is it because they fear if they give out power completely, then there might be a tribunal somewhere down the line where things may not end up happily for them, as has happened in other countries? Yeah.
Well, we can, I mean, that could be, you know, one argument that we could level at them. But firstly, I would like to add to what Michael is saying, that in Indonesia, the civil-military relations has been much more complicated. And Indonesia doesn't have a history of actual direct military interventions. So Indonesian military intervention, the Dwi Fungsi, started from Nasution's middle way. And it's always been done through more a constitutional approach, because there's a loophole in the original Undang-Undang Dasar 45, you know, the original 1945 constitutions, that talks about functional groups. So they, you know, that is the back door that the military used. The military was a functional group. So that was how it was justified, you know, that there was this dual function of the military. While in Myanmar, it was direct interventions, you know, this military coup d'etat, a military junta. So it's a much longer, reform if it were ever to take place. So the military in Myanmar is more like the military in Latin America. It is still possible, but it's a long way to go. Secondly, why does the military feel that it has to hold on to power? For Myanmar, their justification has always been that because Myanmar is very diverse, very fractured, there are endless regional rebellions, conflicts, and so on. They saw the civilian leadership to be divided, corrupt, incompetent. You know, that was the argument that they used in the 1950s and early 60s. And that, again, will be the argument that they use now to justify, you know, the raison d'etre for them. They are the symbol of national unity. They are the one that is, you know, despite the factionalism within the military, that they are the one that has the esprit de corps, you know, the ability to manage the country together, and also to modernize the country in terms of not just political development, but also economic development, because the military has also been very much involved in the economy in Myanmar. So while we can argue that, you know, they're afraid to move away from power for fear of persecution, to them, it is more like a noblesse oblige. You know, this is the Praetorian state, that they see themselves as the legitimate guardian of the state.
I'd just add to that, if I may, you know, that to further to what Dewi said about functional groups, I think it's probably fair to say, in reference to what I said earlier about the seven-step roadmap, that what they're essentially aiming for in the seventh step is where Indonesia was in the 1960s, with the army as a functional group alongside the civilians.
That means that the transition to democracy in Myanmar is not Indonesia 1998, 1999,
no,
but it's Indonesia 1965, yep, basically.
Yeah. But, and, you know, to add to that, I think one thing that is most remarkable evolution about the Indonesian military is that nowadays, whenever you talk politics in front of Indonesian generals or officers, they would just turn their back on you. They're totally not interested. They have no appetite to join any political processes, and they want to be a professional military. So the change of mindset is really quite remarkable for me to see. Right?
Disappointed with the state of Indonesian democracy.
Yes. Yes. Okay, that's another subject.
Sorry, Dino. I mean, we should not beat our chest too much. Indonesian state of Indonesian democracy and the role of the military, recently retired and so on, has also been quite remarkable. Most scholars in Indonesia will say that the Indonesian military is not totally depoliticized yet.
Yes, yes. Okay. All right. Well, there's a whole lot of session on that, yeah. But back to Myanmar. You know, the fact that Aung San Suu Kyi now is under detention reveals much about the total deterioration of relations between Aung San Suu Kyi and the military. How do you think their relationship has changed, you know, since she joined the government in 2012? Because there were some moments where she seemed a bit comfortable with her relationships with the Tatma Dahlia. Anyone?
I mean, it's fair to say that one of the major causes, underlying problems of why we're where we are today is because the state of civil-military relations was very, very bad, particularly since 2015, when Aung San Suu Kyi was elected in that first election, free election in 2015. And I think it's also fair to say that both sides are to blame. Aung San Suu Kyi's style of leadership, her attitude, particularly towards Ming Aulin, with whom she did not have a functioning relationship and has not seen for the last 2 years at least, has not met for the last 2 years at least, contributed a great deal to the sense of frustration on the part of the army leadership, that they weren't getting a hearing, that they didn't actually have a relationship with her. And so the gulf between the civil and military wings of government was just growing wider and wider. I mean, there are underlying causes for that, of course, but I think a primary cause was the lack of chemistry between the two leaders, between Ming Aulin, General Ming Aulin, and Aung San Suu Kyi.
And maybe we can add also, you know, in the earlier period during the first house arrest of Aung San Suu Kyi, she was seen to be very much a victim. You know, the lady, she got the Nobel Prize, you know, the international darling in a way. Mm-hmm. But after Rohingya tragedy and Aung San Suu Kyi's inaction, the government of the NLD was very much defensive and inactive. And you know, in fact, defending the military action, Aung San Suu Kyi lost a lot of credibility in the international community. So, in fact, that is a problem. As on the one hand, the international community, of course, condemns the coup d'état and asks for the military to release all of the political leaders. But at the same time, you know, the international community's attitude towards Aung San Suu Kyi is much more mixed, I would say. You know, she's no longer seen as this lady with a halo on her head.
Yes, and she didn't prove to be the impeccable politician that people thought she was, I guess, also. And you know, I find it interesting that the NLD, Aung San Suu Kyi's party, did better in the elections last year compared to the previous ones. But the USDP, the Union Solidarity and Development Party, which is Tatma Dao's preferred party, did very bad in the last elections. Why did the USDP did so bad, you think, in the recent elections?
Well, the army is not popular, and the reason why the USDP did a little bit better in the 2015 election was, if you like, a hangover effect of the Thein Sein government, which was in a way military-led, but a hybrid government. And they did pretty well on the policy front, and they introduced a lot of the economic reforms that, you know, that powered the initial years of a transition, where suddenly, you know, Myanmar people were, the people of Myanmar were able to afford SIM cards, able to afford cars, you know, all the sort of benefits of an opening. And that was down to President Thein Sein, who himself was from the military, and most of his cabinet was military too. So in the 2015 election, there was a bit of a hangover effect. But by the time you got to 2020, and the military has continued to commit human rights abuses, continue to treat the ethnic regions very poorly. There was the business in Rakhine State, not just with the Rohingya, but with the Rakhine. And so by that time, the military has just become so much more unpopular again. And Aung San Suu Kyi's leadership, you know, had been proven. And even though her style of rule may have been problematic, there was no doubt there was enhanced popularity for her as a leader.
Okay. Dr. Dewi, President Biden has announced that the United States was imposing new limited sanctions on Myanmar, focusing more on personalities and companies. Yeah. How effective have sanctions been for Myanmar?
Well, in the past, it was not terribly effective because Myanmar chose to isolate itself. You know, since Nguyen took over power, Myanmar basically become, you know, very, very inward looking, and it chose not to engage with the outside world. So sanctions against Myanmar was not terribly effective. Myanmar then had close relations with China. But now in the past decade, the economy in Myanmar is flourishing, and the military is directly engaged in business, so they have a lot of stakes in the economy. So I would say that, you know, sanctioning, imposing a wholesale sanction on Myanmar would hurt the people the most, because the military would be able, you know, to cushion itself against the effect of sanctions. But if you target the military's business interests, that might actually hurt them.
Michael?
Well, it's, you know, sanctions are generally ineffective. They hurt the people more than they do the elites and the leaders. And in the case of Myanmar, of course, the army can rely on an extensive underground economy, whether it's jade, whether it's illicit narcotics, whether it's cross-border trade that's not counted as formal trade. There's a tremendous amount of income that they earn from informal and underground economic activities running into the billions of dollars. And so sanctions that hit the formal aspects of the economy are really only going to hurt the people and not the Tatmadaw.
Who do you think should take the lead on Myanmar from the international community? The United States, the European Union, or ASEAN?
Well, I believe that ASEAN should take the lead here. And within ASEAN, Indonesia should take the lead. You know, this is because Myanmar is part of the ASEAN family. And if the political crisis in Myanmar goes on for a longer period, this is going to cause internal problems within ASEAN. It undermines ASEAN unity. And of course, it undermines ASEAN centrality. So ASEAN should take the lead, should be proactive, should not allow itself to be marginalized, you know, by outside actors. And within ASEAN, and I think Michael would agree with me here, that Indonesia is the one that is best placed to do that. Michael has talked about Ibu Retno's shuttle diplomacy, which follows, you know, earlier prime minister diplomacy in Indonesia. And also because the similarity of Indonesian and Myanmar's history, you know, the history of constitutional democracy and military interventions and the difficult path to reform. Although it's not apple to apple, the Indonesian military has much more to share, you know, with Myanmar's military. And also, I think the fact that the civilians in Indonesia also understand that there's no zero-sum game in civil-military relations. You know, there is a need to engage, need to talk, even to the bad guys. And I think that Indonesia has some proven experience on this.
Yeah, but before I get Michael to respond, I want to comment on that. Isn't the situation a bit different now, Dr. Dewi, in the sense that, say, 10 years ago, when we had President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, he was a general, and the Myanmar Tatmadaw generals, Tan Chui and so on, would look up to him because he's a former general. But now, you know, it's a different set of actors now. Do you think the leadership, especially the army leadership in Myanmar, still see Indonesia as a role model and with the same degree of, feeling that they had before, the same degree of respect that they had before, say about 10 years ago? Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry to say this, that in fact, Indonesia's democratic regression in the fact that, you know, one of the criticisms against the Jokowi government, you know, a full-fledged civilian leaders, the child of Reformasi here, and there are more senior military officers, retired generals in the Jokowi government than under the SBY cabinet. This example's bad in terms of Indonesia's democratic credential, probably, but showing to Myanmar that, you know, having civilian leaders not the end of the world for military interests. So I think this, you know, even in this case, not best practices, but probably, you know, our bad practices could also be used to tell Myanmar, you know, that there's still some rooms for protecting military interests, even in a fully democratic government.
Yeah. Michael, I'll go back to the earlier question. The US, EU, or ASEAN should take the lead?
Well, I very much agree with Dewi that, you know, it's ASEAN and it's also Indonesia in ASEAN. You know, I first came to Indonesia in 1987, and I was privy to a lot of the discussions that had around the time when Bakmokdak Kusumatmadra and later Ali Alatas launched the shuttle diplomacy over Cambodia. Later on, of course, Bak Hasan Wiryuda launched shuttle diplomacy to bring peace to southern Philippines. And then Bak Marti used shuttle diplomacy in three areas, really, in the South China Sea, in the Rohingya crisis, and also rather unsuccessfully between Thailand and Cambodia. And so it's part of what Ibu Retno has been doing is very much part of a long tradition of Indonesian activism in foreign policy that leads within ASEAN. And it's not always easy. It's particularly difficult for Thailand, for instance, to stomach the notion that Indonesia is leading on this issue when Myanmar is Thailand's neighbor and Thailand is a major country within ASEAN, although it's lost a great deal of its regional capacity over the last decade. And so it's not going to be easy for Indonesia, but continue they must. And it's very much part of a strong and successful tradition of Indonesia leading the regional organization, not just because it's the biggest country. I think as Dewi indicated, it's more complicated than that. It's a long history of activism. It's the fact that Indonesia's foreign policy tends to be more idealistic, democratic or otherwise, than some of the neighboring countries, which more or less look after their interests. And you'd say that foreign policy is always about interests, but Indonesia's interests are so rooted in the revolutionary struggle for independence and how it achieved it, that I think that activism continues and carries through. And as Dewi said, with Myanmar, there is a special place. Myanmar was able to help Indonesia in the revolutionary struggle, and there's still that hutang budi, if you like, a little bit. So I think that for all those reasons, Indonesia is in the lead. Now, of course, the downside of all this, Dino, is that ASEAN still burdened by the heavy presence of states who will not tolerate interference in their neighbors. They stick very strongly to the non-interference principle. And we're seeing how now ASEAN is divided on this issue, very much more so than ever before, where Indonesia, Malaysia, Brunei perhaps, Singapore are very much in favor of a more proactive stance on Myanmar. But the mainland countries of Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos are very much standing back and not wanting to interfere. And so, yes, ASEAN in the lead. And I think the US and China are behind that, which is very interesting. It's a geopolitical impact that is a dividend in a way that both China and the US are on the same page in pushing ASEAN to be in front. You have the EU and other European and the UK, for instance, wanting to be more active, considering establishing envoys. And of course, you know, you have the UN not playing much of a role either in the current circumstances. So yes, ASEAN in the lead with support from the major powers.
Well, let me bring you to the statement by ASEAN foreign ministers meeting that met virtually on 2nd of March. The statement stressed the need for political stability in any ASEAN country, calling for a refrain from violence and calling for peaceful solution through constructive dialogue, and also expressed ASEAN's readiness to assist Myanmar in a positive, peaceful, and constructive manner. Doesn't mention about democracy, doesn't mention about elections, doesn't mention about the military coup and the fact that, you know, it's not a good idea. It wasn't a good thing to do, and so on. Yeah. What is your take on this? There's only one paragraph on Myanmar, actually two. The other one was a smaller reference. But what is your take on this? It seemed like a painful paragraph regarding Myanmar's political development.
I actually think it's a bit unfair on the meeting, because what actually happened in the meeting was that half the countries in ASEAN refused to say anything at all until the subject of Myanmar came up, which is very significant, because they weren't playing along with the notion that this was just a meeting about general issues and Myanmar would be one topic. I think it's fair to say that certainly Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore, also the Philippines, basically only spoke at the meeting about Myanmar. And in that respect, I think strong messages were sent. The chairman's statement was not necessarily a fair reflection of the candor of that meeting. But nonetheless, it put a face on that meeting that satisfied the other half of ASEAN that was not in favor of making strong statements and sending a strong message to Myanmar. So it was a compromise.
Yeah, Dr. Dewi?
Yeah, just following on Myakal, this is the typical ASEAN. You know, if there is a short sentence that says, you know, after long discussion, ASEAN agrees on this. It means that there's a long discussions of disagreement, and this is really papering over it. And here again, you know, the how do we go forward? I think we have to admit the fact that we have to bring ASEAN into this. ASEAN should, wherever possible, be the one that try to host meeting. But following what happened on Cambodia, if you remember, you know, it was only later on that ASEAN come on board. It was Indonesia that started with Pak Muhtar's cocktail parties, and then Pak Ali Alatas then came with a Jakarta informal meeting. And it was only after that happened that Indonesia was formally appointed by ASEAN as an interlocutor for ASEAN on Cambodia. So if it is not possible for ASEAN 9 here, or ASEAN, clearly not ASEAN 10, to come to a consensus on how to go ahead on Myanmar, I think here I would fully agree and support Indonesia and other fellow ASEAN countries, you know, to find a modality, an informal meeting, take turns hosting informal meetings in Jakarta or in Indonesia, in Malaysia, Singapore, you know, and other countries that are willing to do that and host informal meetings to talk to which are inclusive in nature. So, you know, at the moment, the supporters of NLD are angry with Indonesia and angry also with ASEAN, which are willing, you know, to talk to the military because they think that the military should simply be isolated and just be forced to stand over power. But here in this case, it's not that if we want to have a peaceful political resolutions, we need to be able to bring all the parties together.
I would add to that, that, you know, in addition to what Dewi is proposing, which I think is beginning to happen, I think it's clear that the four countries, you know, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore and Brunei are going to be very active and they're going to move ahead together and separately, quite actively. I think in addition to that, it's very important that ASEAN starts to break the mold in terms of tolerating, encouraging, supporting, endorsing civil society action and dialogue. And this is something that's always been very difficult in ASEAN. There's no respect for civil society. There's no place given to civil society, apart from the symbolic ways in which they do it at every summit and so on. And so I think it's really important to mobilize track two mechanisms, the ASEAN ISIS network, CSIS Jakarta has been very active on this issue. Also looking perhaps at mobilizing the ASEAN parliamentarians who have their own grouping, who want to be very active in advocating and engaging with the protest movement. And similarly with some of the human rights organizations. This is something, the time has come. You know, ASEAN can no longer just do it at the official level. There has to be a more nuanced approach to engagement. And of course, you know, it's all very well for Ibu Retno to say that I'm engaging with the CRPH, but actually it could be done more effectively by civil society in a much broader and inclusive way, because it's not just CRPH that's in the protest movement.
Yeah, I want to bring back to the early point raised by Dr. Dewi that we saw some protests from Myanmar, which actually, regarding what they saw as ASEAN including Indonesia going along with the plan by the Tatmadaw to hold elections in 1 year. So there seems to be strong resistance on the ground about that pathway. Do you think that ASEAN should continue to go down that route as the way forward, which is to count on a new elections organized by the Tatmadaw, or at least backed by them, to deliver the next political round for Myanmar?
I think it has to be clarified, Dino, because Indonesia and ASEAN never said that, you know, that they will accept that.
But it was leaked in the Reuters news by Indonesian officials talking about that, yes?
Yeah, but I think it says, you know, it's not the formal authoritative position of Indonesia or ASEAN. So I think that the default position of Indonesia would be, you know, to try firstly to stop the escalating violence there, to call for restraint, and then to bring all the parties, into a negotiating table, which means, of course, that those leaders who are under house arrest or in jail must be released, because otherwise, how will they be able to take part in this dialogue? And then thirdly, you know, to try to find some compromise positions. And for us, you know, the November 2020 elections is a legitimate election. This is not accepted by the military, but this is, you know, this is a legitimate election that must be respected. So I think we should regard that as a default position first.
Yeah, but we're still going to hit that wall at some point.
I don't think we should preempt. The most important thing is to bring all the parties to the negotiating table. So I don't think we should preempt. What would be the results? If you say that, you know, oh, we ASEAN will support this or that, that means that we actually preempt what the people in Myanmar actually want to agree upon.
I very much agree with Dewi that, let's be clear, the negotiation process, when it takes place between the parties in Myanmar, will be an internal process. It will be internally led and internally facilitated. And of course, all countries would say the same thing. It's our mess. We're going to resolve it. The point being that Myanmar is unique at the same time amongst ASEAN countries as being the only country where ASEAN has successfully created mechanisms for dealing with internal matters. And so we saw it started with Cyclone Nargis in 2008 with the creation of a special mechanism for ASEAN to cooperate with the international community in the rescue efforts in Cyclone Nargis. It followed on after 2017 with the ASEAN Humanitarian Assistance Center being invited to conduct a needs assessment on the potential for repatriation of Rohingya refugees. And it then led to a completely unprecedented creation of an ad hoc team within the Secretariat with a mandate from the Myanmar government to assist in the repatriation process. And this is the only country in ASEAN that has allowed this to happen. So there is a role for ASEAN inside Myanmar. But I suspect, as Indonesia has pointed in some of the statements that Ibu Retno has made, that it's going to be more in the area of humanitarian access, the possibility of distributing vaccines, a sort of a support function in terms of relief for the country. But the negotiation process and how they resolve the conflict will be internally driven. But that's not to say the country won't need help. I mean, I've been told, for instance, right now that no one is measuring how many people have COVID. No one is taking data and statistics about the extent to which COVID-19 is prevalent in Myanmar. The public health system has completely broken down. There is going to be a need for ASEAN to help afterwards.
Yeah. One thing that everybody is worried about is the potential bloodshed in Myanmar. And things are getting more tense now. Pressures on the ground are really felt, and there's been some shootings resulting in some death in Myanmar. How serious do you think this is? Will it get worse? And can do we expect worsening conditions in terms of violence?
Yes. My understanding is that from the army's point of view, their strategy is to continue to ramp up and increase the pressure on the protesters using increasing levels of lethal force and force and lethal force in the hope that this will gradually reduce the numbers of people in the street, tire out, exhaust, shock, intimidate the protesters themselves, so that eventually a semblance of normality is restored and they can proceed with their plans. It's a vain hope so far, because these tactics don't appear to be working. Although yesterday was the first day without fatalities, today it looks like it's also fairly quiet. And it could be that's because there's a UN Security Council meeting going on, so that they've held back a bit from that strategy of using lethal force. But to consider that on Wednesday, almost 40 people were killed, is a very, very strong indication that more and more violence is likely. Mm.
Dr. Dewi, Myanmar's political developments always involve concerns over ethnic rebellions. What is the update on that? And is there a concern that Aung San Suu Kyi government has not been entirely successful in dealing with these ethnic rebellions?
Yeah, I mean, the ethnic rebellions have been ongoing. But I think that what we have to say here is that, you know, the civilian government under Aung San Suu Kyi had very little control over the military operations in the regions. So if you look at the division of power, you know, the defense force, the home ministry, and the ones who are in charge of dealing with the regions are fully in the hands of the military. So the military's hotline on this, although there's some attempts at negotiations. In fact, here they also learn from Indonesia. We have hosted, you know, in Indonesia, the Institute for Peace and Democracy of the Bali Democracy Forum, for example, actually hosted a meeting in Bali at one point when several military officers who are involved in dealing with the regional rebellions came to Indonesia to learn about how we resolve the situations in Aceh. So there are attempts there, but unfortunately, the default drive, you know, the default mode of the military tends to be, you know, harsh measures over dialogues.
Yeah, I remember when I accompanied President SBY when he went to Myanmar and he talked to the leadership there. The ones that got their imagination or attention the most is when we express our sympathies with the efforts to preserve national unity on Myanmar, because that's the same problem that we have in Indonesia. But that angle seemed to capture the attention most than on democracy and other issues. Yeah, Mike, you want to comment on the ethnic rebellion part? Is there a chance that some of the ethnic groups are feeling sidelined even after the military coup that occurred recently?
Well, I think actually there's also the possibility of a more optimistic outlook. We should remember that in the elections that happened in November last year, the ethnic parties didn't do completely badly. The ethnic political parties, the Shan National League for Development, in fact, the SNLD, ended up getting the second highest number of votes in the country. Even, you know, obviously the USDP did very badly. And so the ethnic parties may actually now be in a better position. They may have more leverage. Just before the coup and after the election, the NLD had, in a rather clumsy way, reached out to the ethnic parties and said, okay, let's talk about power sharing. But it was badly done. You know, the ethnic parties were not happy with the NLD. And in fact, you know, were it not for the coup, we probably would be talking about the severe problems that the civilian elected government is having with the ethnic parties, because they've been unable to agree on power sharing. And it goes back to the 2015 election, where Aung San Suu Kyi refused to allow ethnic parties to actually run the states in which they had a majority of votes. So in Rakhine State, where the ethnic parties won a majority, the NLD was appointed as chief minister. And that was, in fact, what triggered the violent conflict in Rakhine State. And similarly, in other states, they were very unhappy with the NLD. So in many ways, a reset, if that's possible, not so much of the election itself, but of the political topography, would actually help give the ethnic parties more of a say. And that's ultimately good in terms of their aim, which is a federal system.
If I can add here, there's also an element of you know, communal issues here. I think Dino and Michael, because the NLD is basically Burman, basically Buddhist. And as we see in the Rakhine State, you know, the Aung San Suu Kyi was very, the policy of the central government is very much backed by radical Buddhist monks. And while most of the ethnic minorities, it's not just minority in terms of ethnicity, but also in religions, like a lot of them are Christians. So here, ironically, the military sometimes, you know, is seen to be a more of a national unifying force, because it's not just Burmans and Buddhists, while, you know, NLD tends to be much more Burman and Buddhist. So, you know, it's less capable also engaging with ethnic minorities.
Yeah, it comes back to the next issue of the election, you know, because as you say, as you said earlier, you know, there's a lot of resistance to redoing the election because, of course, the legitimacy of the NLD. But in fact, if there was to be a new system of proportional representation in fresh elections, undoubtedly the ethnic parties would do even better. The NLD will probably still win. And, you know, it might create a sort of a more proportionally equal, not completely equal, but more proportionally equal electoral map. I think at the end of the day, what the ethnic groups are looking for is of course, moving towards this goal of a federal system. And for that, it's not just about ceasefires with the military and working out arrangements for demobilization, disarmament. It's also about political arrangements. And I think it's very important that that the ethnic parties are given more of a say in whatever comes next.
Thank you. So we've come to the end of our talk. I have one final question. It is often said that China and India are the most influential external players in Myanmar. How true is that? And can you explain the dynamics of India's and China's influence in Myanmar? Yeah. Michael first, and then Dr. Dewi. Yeah.
Okay. India has been surprisingly quiet. India's under a lot of pressure now from the US and Japan and its allies in the Quad, so to speak, but also European powers to say more and be more proactive. But for India, the problem is that, you know, relationships with the Tatmadaw were quite good. Security cooperation along the long border between India and Myanmar has been good. They have quite a bit of investment riding inside of, particularly in Rakhine State, strategic investment. And so India has been very quiet. China has also been quiet. The advantage that that India has is that no one in Myanmar has the perception that India is backing the Tatmadaw, whereas the perception in Myanmar amongst many, many people is that the Chinese are great supporters of the Tatmadaw. I think that's not really particularly true. Certainly the Tatmadaw don't like the Chinese. I do think, though, that it's more likely that China will step in at some stage, possibly quietly, possibly by sending a senior official down to Naypyidaw, banging the table as they have in the past and as they have in other countries, and insisting that things are done a certain way. But we haven't got to that stage yet.
Dr. Dewi?
Yeah, there is this, you know, India is the world's largest democracy. And one expects that India will act more in support of democratic forces in Myanmar. But this is not the case, even during the earlier period of democratic transitions, when ASEAN and Indonesia were trying to engage Myanmar, to assist Myanmar in its democratic transition. India was not interested. And I remember at one Shangri-La dialogue, where probably you were also there, Dr. Dino, when, you know, I posed a question to the Indian minister, defense minister, that, and his answer was very interesting because he said, India is not in the business of exporting democracy. So they're not engaged here. In terms of economic engagements, I'm not really sure. I'm not up to date. Historically, of course, you know, Myanmar was part of the British colony run from India. So relations with India is a bit problematic also because, you know, there's Nguyen actually expelled the Indian ethnic in Myanmar at the time. So, but now, you know, in the modern time, I'm not sure to what extent India is really an important economic player yet. China is the most important economic player in Myanmar, particularly in the northern area, the most important investor. So Myanmar is, of course, very nationalistic. The Tatmadaw is very nationalistic. They don't like the Chinese. But the fact of the matter is, during the period when Myanmar is under sanction, it was the support from the Chinese that actually helped to float the Myanmar's economy, besides all of those illegal underground economic activities with Thailand. So now China is a very important player. And for us, it is the most important thing is there's a concern that the geopolitical rivalry between the US and China could actually be played out also in Myanmar, you know, where Myanmar could support one side, the Tatmadaw, and the US could support the democratic forces. You know, that was one of the concerns that have been expressed. And clearly, ASEAN does not want this. You know, it is important that as has been mentioned earlier by Marco, that China and the United States are on the same page, give ASEAN, allow ASEAN the lead here and support whatever initiatives that ASEAN is doing.
Okay. Well, one final question. Michael, I've known you since when you were a journalist for Far Eastern Economic Review magazine. That was like a long time ago, right? So you've seen how the region progressed, and you've always been an astute analyst, student of the region. And what happened in Myanmar recently sheds light on the question of non-intervention, right? Which is a sacred ASEAN principle, right? But what I want to know is, have we evolved on how we look at and apply this question of non-interference? Times have changed, and what is the limit of this non-interference? Because not everything can be justified by non-interference, right? And the same question to Dewi after Michael. Yes.
Well, I've always believed that, in a part of the world where nationhood is less than 80 years old, 8 decades for the most part, it's still a relatively short time. And so we're always going to see a very strong assertion of sovereignty, driving that sort of fear of interference. And of course, the two great experiences of the last 150 years, which was the colonial period and also the invasion of the Japanese Imperial Army, I think makes this region, very allergic to interference and fearful of outside intervention. I think also, 80 years is not a long time for a region to become cohesive and coherent in social and social terms, let alone economic terms. The countries are still very much the countries unto themselves. But having said that, each time something like this happens, we reach a juncture where increasingly society says, look, we can't go on this way. We have values to defend and uphold. We increasingly tend to have common values. Most of the countries in one form or another practice a form of pluralistic, semi-democratic government, even if not perfect. And I think citizenry is increasingly saying, look, we can't let this happen. And I go back to the point I made at the very beginning, that the difference this time around is very hard to cover your eyes and cover your ears from what's happening in Myanmar, because of the way that social media this time around has played such an important role. I was in the region in 1988, and I can tell you that I heard and read about what was going on the streets of Myanmar, but I didn't see what was going on. And you couldn't feel that outrage until the stories trickled out afterwards. And so I think it's important to recognize that now, with the way that social media has developed, it's very difficult for governments to ignore what their citizens are saying about what they should be doing to address these problems, which I think does put pressure on non-interference and the culture of non-intervention.
Yeah, and in fact, if ASEAN is truly a family, they should actually welcome expressions of concern or ideas or policy inputs, so long as they're given in a good spirit. At least that's my view. Dr. Dewi.
Yeah, just adding on to what Michael and you have said, Dr. Dino, actually, ASEAN has moved forward. The existence of the ASEAN Charter is very important. It's very the fact of the matter is that the Indonesian Prime Minister, the other Prime Ministers in ASEAN countries and ASEAN itself have been able to cite language from the ASEAN Charter
on paper. Yes.
Yeah. So when we talk about principle of non-interference is not an ASEAN invention. It is in the UN Charter. That is the basis of international relations, after all. Because if all countries intervene in each other, there'll be continuing conflict. So, the basic default of international relations that you do not interfere in the political workings of other countries. Like in the US, campaign finance, if foreign countries interfering in domestic politics is a no-no. So this is a universal principle. But in ASEAN, it has tended to be regarded as a sacrosanct, that even gross violations of human rights have tended to be protected behind national borders. But with the ASEAN Charter, that's changed. It has not gone as far as we would have liked in terms of reforming the political culture in the region. But the fact of the matter is that the ASEAN Charter actually mentions about the importance of democracy, protections of human rights, rule of law, good governance, and that ASEAN leaders who are criticizing Myanmar actually not quoting the UN Charter, but quoting the ASEAN Charter. I think that that's very important.
Yes, I agree. And you know, I do think that, you know, the act of abolishing or abrogating the election results and arresting the winners of those elections, and then launching acts of suppression and so on. And for them to expect that ASEAN do not say anything, but their neighbors don't say anything, I think is hard to accept. If anything like that happens in our region, and if it happens in Indonesia, you know, I would expect our neighbors and the international community to speak about it. Right. So yes, I think yes, intervention is still important concept, but you know, there are limits to it, and I think you know, countries should speak up whenever there is a serious violation of democracy and human rights. Yeah. So, but with that, please.
And finally,
please,
don't forget, you know, there is internationally, there is this responsibility to protect, the principle of responsibility to protect. So we'll be remiss, the international community will be very remiss if we allow, you know, the violence to continue in Myanmar, because this is a regional and international concern, it's not just a national concern in Myanmar.
Good. Well, Dr. Dewi and Michael, I wish we have another hour, but I want to thank you for your sharing your thoughts with us. I have enjoyed very much, and I'm sure our listeners have also learned a lot from your comments. This is your host, Dino Patijalal, and I hope you enjoy today's discussion on Myanmar's political development. Don't forget to share and subscribe Eyes on Southeast Asia on your favorite streaming platform. Follow FPCI social media for more information about our activities, upcoming events, and programs. See you. Bye-bye.